The Sedra begins with the words V'yikhu li truma. So the Mefarshim point out that really it should say V'yitnu li truma, that people are giving an offering to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not taking one. A simple answer is that the Torah is talking to the Gaboyim, who are going around to collect the offerings that Klal Yisrael make, and it's telling them, V'yikhu li truma, take that truma, me'es kol ashir venu libo. That's the simple pshat. But the deeper implication is what the Gemara says in Bava Basra. Turnus Rufus HaRosha once asked Rabbi Akiva, if God loves Aniyim so much, why doesn't he support them? Why does he leave it up to other people to do his work? And Rabbi Akiva said that obviously HaKadosh Baruch Hu can support the Aniyim. In fact, if you think about it, if you believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the world and he commands Ashirim to give tzedakah to Aniyim, that means that he gives the Ashirim money that he expects them to give to the Aniyim. So God could cut out the middleman and give the Ani the money directly. But Rabbi Akiva said, the purpose of the tzedakah is not for the sake of the Ani, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu Taka could support the Ani directly. But it's in order to be mezakeh the Ashirim, that they should have that schus of being able to give that tzedakah. The purpose of tzedakah is not mainly for the Ani, the purpose is mainly for the Asher. And therefore the Gemara says, based on a pasuk in Megillas Rus, Rus told Naomi, Ha'ish asher osisi imo hayom shmo Boaz. The man I did for today, his name was Boaz. What did she do for him? She gathered the crops from his field and took the matnas aniyim, took the chalokim that were meant for the aniyim. So she did something for him, he did for her. So the Gemara learns from that, Yosher mimashe ha'osher osim ha'ani. More than what the osher does for the ani, ha'ani osim ha'osher. The ani does with the osher. Because the osher only gives the ani money which God could give him. But the ani avails the osher to a mitzvah which even God can't give him, because HaKol Bidei Shemayim Chutz Meir HaShemayim. So the ikr of the tzedakah is for the sake of the usher, not necessarily for the sake of the ani. And that's why a few interesting halachas. Tzedakah is measured not so much by what you give, because the Rambam says that if you give a lot but you give it b'sever panim ra'os, that it could be that you're not even yotze the mitzvah. The main thing is ahavas chesed, how much the usher enjoys and is nehenna from the mitzvah of tzedakah, enjoys doing it. Because the ikar is how it affects the usher, not so much what the ani receives. And therefore, the Rambam says on the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, hakol lefi rov hamaaseh, that it's better to give a lot of people smaller amounts of tzedakah than to give it all in one place at one time. Because the main way that a person is judged in this world is on how many things he does. Not how much quality, but quantity. The fact that you do something over and over again conditions you to do it more. So it's better to give more times tzedakah, less each time, than to give one big time. If the purpose would be for the ani, that wouldn't be the case. But if the purpose is for the sake of the usher, then it makes sense. I was thinking that also explains on Purim. On Purim we have matanos levyonim. You give one thing to two different aniyim. But mishloach manos, you give two different things to your rich friend. Wouldn't it be better to give two things to the poor person, not two things to the rich person? Rich person, give two things. The Ani, but you only have to give one person. The Matanas Levyonim, you have to give two people, but you only give one thing to each one. But it bears this out completely. That tzedakah, it's better to give more times, and the ikar is not for the Ani. The ikar is for you. So therefore you can give him one thing, but give to two people. Masha'en came, the usher, the main thing is the present that you're giving him, right, that there should be ava, achva, vareus, so give him two things. The same limud we find by supporting Torah. This applies to tzedakah, the yikhuli truma. Therefore it says, let them take truma, because by giving, they're really taking. By giving, they're really benefiting themselves. The one who gives is the one who really benefits. By hachzokas haTorah, by supporting Torah, the supporters of Torah were hinted to in the badim that carried the aron. The aron is the Talmidei Chachamim, the repository of the Torah, and the people who carried the Torah and the badim with which they carried it is symbolic of the people who support Torah. And we know that a nes happened, that the aron carried the people who carried it. That even though it appeared like the people who were supporting the Torah were supporting it, but in fact the Torah supported them. And in fact, the Chofetz Chaim says that that's the meaning of the following pasuk. Eitz Chaim hi l'machazikim bo, v'somcheho me'ushor. The Torah is a tree of life to those that hold on to it, and for those who support it, they're fortunate. Says the Chofetz Chaim, what it means is the following. There are two attitudes that a person can have in supporting Torah. The first attitude is that I'm doing the Torah and Talmidei Chachamim a favor by supporting them. If I wouldn't support them, who knows what would be. A person who has that attitude is me'ushar. He's fortunate. But for him, it's not an Eitz Chaim. To whom is the Torah an Eitz Chaim? Lemachazikim ba. The word lahachazik means to hold on to something for dear life. When a person's drowning and they throw him a log to hold on to, so he's machzik, he holds on to that log for dear life. That's called lahachazik. When is the Torah in Eitz Chaim? Lemachazikim ba. When a person understands that by supporting Torah, he's supporting himself, that he's the beneficiary, that he's the one really who's holding on to the Torah for dear life. For that kind of person, the Torah is an Eitz Chaim. For the people who think that they're supporting the Torah, so they're ma'ushar. They're vadi get schar, they're vadi fortunate, but for them, it's not an Eitz Chaim. Famous story they tell to bring this idea out, the founder of Telzer Yeshiva, Blazer Gordon. So when he was just married, his father-in-law was Avram Yitzchok Neviezer, who was the Rav in Ashishak. And he was a rabbi, he wasn't a rich man, but he recognized that his son-in-law had the ability, the potential, to be one of the Gedolei Yisrael. He was a very talented young man, big Talmud Chacham, and he knew that if he could learn without worrying about Parnasa, for a number of years, he could develop his potential. So he offered the couple that they should live with the parents, and they would eat at the parents' table, and basically they wouldn't have any expenses. And for 5 years, the parents would take care of their expenses living with them. Father and mother were not wealthy people, but in this way they could see to it that the son-in-law was able to learn without worrying about Parnassus. So they stayed with the in-laws with the wife's parents for 5 years. And at the end of the 5 years, they already had a few little children. And he was offered a position, a rabbonish position somewhere. And he felt that the proper thing to do is, the 5 years are up, to go and take the rabbonish and start supporting themselves. His in-laws had a hard time supporting them altogether, so he felt that, you know, the 5 years was sufficient, and now's the time to go out on their own. So he told his wife to go and ask permission from her father to leave. So the wife comes in, and she says to her father, "My husband was offered a rabbonis. We've been here 5 years. That was what you offered, and we're ready to leave and to make it on our own." The father turned white, and he said, "Nothing doing. You have to stay another 5 years. And if it's money, I'll add something, but you have to stay." So she went back to her husband, and she told him. And he said, "I feel uncomfortable. We're already here 5 years. I do have the opportunity to earn a parnasa by taking this rabbonis. But if it makes such a difference to your father, right, and he really means it, then out of deference to him, we'll stay another 5 years." So they stayed another 5 years, and now they had older children, and the expenses were greater. And he was offered, at the end of the second 5 years, a very prestigious rabbonis, and he really wanted to take it. So he sent his wife again to ask permission from her father. She told him that this time he had a very prestigious rabbonis that was offered, and you know, it's that the expenses are getting more, our family is growing and getting older, the children are older, and there's more expenses. And at that point, the mother was there too. And the mother said to her husband, "You know, she's right. How long can we support them?" And the father turned to her and said, "I don't know who's supporting who. But I'm not going to stand in the way of my son-in-law's career, and I'm giving them permission to go." And the day they left to take up the rabbonis, the father-in-law died. And at that point, they understood who's supporting who. So, Eitzchayim hi lemachazikim ba. The Torah is a tree of life to the people who understand that when they support the Torah, they are really supporting themselves. The yikhu li truma. Not giving, but you're taking. And the Chafetz Chaim himself, who said these divrei Torah, lived it too. They tell a maisa with the Chafetz Chaim, "I'm waiting for somebody to give me this nesoyin, and I'm sure I'm going to fail it." But the Chafetz Chaim, somebody once approached him and said, "I would like to underwrite the entire deficit of the yeshiva of Radin. I will pay whatever you can't raise, I'll pay your budget." And the Chafetz Chaim said, "I appreciate the offer, but I can't accept it." So the man said, "Why not? Is something wrong with my money?" He said, "No." He said, "God could support my yeshiva too. He could take care of the deficit. So why doesn't he?" "Because he wants to give Klal Yisrael the schus of having a share in the yeshiva of Radin. I can't let you take the whole thing. It has to be available to other people too." Now I'm sure that if the Panovich Rav was offered this, he would have taken the whole thing and built another yeshiva too. So, but in any case, that's what the Chofetz Chaim said. I appreciate the offer, but I believe that God could support my yeshiva. And if he doesn't, then it's not for my sake, it's for your sake that he's giving you the opportunity. And I can't let you take it all. Other people have to be able to benefit also. Could be with this, you can understand what the sin of the Nesiyim was. The Nesiyim said, "We'll wait and not give anything to the Mishkan, and we'll see whatever Klal Yisrael don't bring, we will make up the deficit." And in the end, Klal Yisrael didn't bring three very valuable things. They didn't bring the shemen for the menorah, the shemen lamor, right? They didn't bring the besamim for the shemen hamishra and the ketores, and they didn't bring the precious stones for the ephod and the choshen. Very expensive things. And the Nesiyim brought these things the Nesiyim brought. And they were punished. That a yud was left out of their name in the Torah, Nesiyim is written without a yud. So the question is, what did they do wrong? Lamaisa, they said that whatever Klal Yisrael don't bring, we'll bring, and in the end they brought a lot of valuable things. So why were they punished? So the simple idea is because they didn't rush in right away. They said, we'll wait and see, whatever they don't bring, and if Klal Yisrael had brought everything, there would be nothing for them to bring. Zrizim Akdimah L'mitzvos, they shouldn't have waited to see what others would bring, they should have rushed in and done on their own. That's what's normally learned. But L'maisa, in the end, they did bring. What was the problem? I think that the problem was their whole attitude. What was their attitude? We'll see what the deficit is, what's missing, and we'll make up the deficit for what Klal Yisrael don't bring. Their whole attitude was crooked. There is no deficit. It's absurd to think God says, look, I'd like you guys to build a Mishkan. Could you donate some things? What do you mean donate some things? God could create all the materials new from nothing, that all the Mishkan was needed. God needs to go and schnorr materials from Klal Yisrael to build a Mishkan? The whole world is His. Bring it, create it. Have to ask you for it. It's obviously, there's no deficit. There's nothing missing. God could provide it all. So why is He asking us for it? Because He wants to give us the benefit. He wants to give us the schus. So the whole concept of waiting to see what was needed and we'll make up the deficit was a totally distorted idea. And therefore, what was the punishment? A yud was left out of their names. With the yud, the word nesiim means those who carry other people. But without the yud, you can read it nisa'im, the people who are being carried. You think that you're carrying, you're the ones making up the deficit, you're doing God a favor by donating to His Mishkan and enabling Him to build the Mishkan. You think you're the carriers? You're not the carriers. You're the people who are being carried. The Aron, the people who carried it, looked like they were carrying the Aron. But in fact, the Aron carried them. Supporting Torah, giving tzedakah, is not helping others per se. It's basically helping yourself. So that is the lesson of the Yikuli Truma. Any questions on this, or go to something else? Yeah.
How do we know that the Nesiim didn't just think that they wanted to give them what was supposed to be Yisrael?
That they wanted to give up the schus?
No, they wanted to give the schus of like, donating stuff to Bnei Yisrael, so they didn't donate anything.
I hear, but if that was their intention, they could have said, look, we'll take this and you take the rest. Right? Even if, and then they would have given in the beginning. But their intention was, look, let them bring, and we'll make up the deficit. That's krum. There's no deficit, right? They didn't say, let them get the schus, and then we'll wait in line and we'll get the schus later. But they said, we'll make up the deficit. That's a problem. Okay. Next. Says that the Aron was gold on the inside and gold on the outside. And we learn from that a Talmud Chacham has to be Tocho Kibaro. His inside and outside have to be equal. Should be on the inside like he is on the outside. Shouldn't put on a show on the outside. And he should represent to people on the outside what he is on the inside. The inside and outside should both be gold. That's how a Talmud Chacham has to be. So the Das Akenemi Balei Atosis asks a very simple question. If that's the symbolism of covering the Aron on the inside with gold and on the outside with gold, wouldn't it have been better if the Aron was solid gold? It wasn't. It was predominantly wood that was covered on the inside and the outside with gold. Right? Moshe Rabbeinu had three boxes. A little box of gold that fit into a medium size of wood box, and the wooden box fit into a larger box of gold on the outside, so it was covered inside and outside. But if the symbolism was that a Talmud Chacham has to be gold on the inside and gold on the outside, wouldn't it have been better if the Aron was solid gold? So he gives a very simple Balabatisha answer. He says 100%. It would have been much more symbolic had the Aron been solid gold, but it would have been too heavy to carry. A box of solid gold of those dimensions would have been impossible to carry. He says, a nace happened, and the Aron carried the people who carried it, so what difference does it make how heavy it was? Ein somchem al nace. It had to be able to be carried naturally. Can't rely on miracles. Finished. Nice. Balabata Shadazakenim. Let me tell you what I learned from that. Tell you a story. I had a girl in my kahila many, many years ago in Miami. She was about 15, 16 years old. She lived with her mother. Her father was completely out of the picture. I have no idea why. It could be he wasn't Jewish. I have no idea. I'd never met the father, and I didn't know why the father wasn't in the picture, but I knew the mother and the daughter, and they were in my kahila. The mother was totally estranged from Yiddishkeit. She knew nothing about Yiddishkeit. And the girl happened to go to NCSY, and she became frum. And here's a 15-year-old girl who's frum, right, balas tshuva, and as is customary, she was a tremendous machmir in everything. Because she didn't know what was right, what was wrong, right? Whatever she heard, she did, to the extreme. And she drove her mother crazy. Because her mother knew nothing about Yiddishkeit. And every day it was something new, right? But the mother was a very, very good mother. And whatever the daughter wanted, Yiddishkeit-wise, she went along with. She didn't do malacha in the house on Shabbos, and they had a Shabbos meal. They koshered the house, made it completely kosher. She went out and bought her a whole new wardrobe of clothing so she could dress sanua. Whatever the girl wanted, the mother went along with. No problem, she made it easy for her. But the mother really had no idea what was going on. Every day was a new chiddush to her. The doll came up with this and that, and she used to come to me to ask me, is this really necessary? Right? Is my daughter got it right? Is she making these things up? One day, the mother comes to me, and she says, Rabbi, I don't understand. Aren't you an Orthodox rabbi? I said, yeah. She said, then how come you don't keep kosher? So, let me give you a little background. In those times in Miami, there was one glatt kosher butcher shop that everybody in the community bought their meat from. The meat was brought in from Denver, glatt kosher, perfectly okay. All the rabbonim, the Orthodox rabbis of the kehila, who were part of the Orthodox Rabbinical Council, gave their hashgacha to this butcher shop. However, there was a group of people in the community, and some of them were the rabbanim who gave the hechsher to this butcher shop, who wanted something more. Specifically, the meat that came from Denver didn't have chassidish shechita. Chassidish shechita is not halacha, right? The meat was 100% halachically okay. But there's some kpedas that certain chassidim have that are not halachic kpedas, but they're hidurim. For instance, they want a shochet who, aside from knowing the laws of shechita, and knows what to do, and is a big Yirei Shamayim, also has a beard. And if he doesn't have a beard, then there's a hither not to use the shechita, only if people have beards. That's one. There's other things. So they decided that they're going to bring meat in for people who want the chassidish shechita special. But they couldn't make a butcher shop for it. There wasn't enough demand. And they couldn't make the whole community get that because it was very impractical. So in order to get that meat special, if you wanted it, you had to get it like every 6 months. That's how much they could bring it in. And if you had to get it 6 months, you get 6 months of meat. That means you had to get a whole four quarters of an animal, which they cut up, and they had somebody butcher it, and you had to get a special freezer to hold this meat because nobody had room in the regular freezer for such a big order of meat. And they had one central pickup place, which was about 30 miles round trip to pick up the meat in a central location. And because it was only being brought in for a small amount of people, it was very expensive. It was about double the expense of the regular meat. Okay. So this mother says to me, my daughter tells me that we can't buy meat in the butcher shop that you give hashgacha to, and that all the rabbis buy their meat from, because it's not kosher. We have to get this kosher meat that we pick up once every 6 months. I have to buy a freezer to store it. I have to travel 30 miles round trip to pick it up, and it costs double the cost of the other meat. Now, I don't understand. I thought you were an Orthodox rabbi. Why don't you eat kosher meat? You give your hashgacha to what my daughter tells me is not kosher. So I said, I'll take care of your daughter. So I called the girl in, and I told her the following. I said, you know, if you would be married and you would have to go pick up the meat and buy the freezer and spend the extra money, then that would be a tremendous thing that you should be mahadir to get only chasidish shechita. But you're not married. And it's your mother who has to buy the freezer, and your mother who has to make the trip, and your mother has to spend all that extra money. And then I told her this das akeinami balei atosfas. And I said, you know what, sometimes it's very, very good to be solid gold. But if the people who have to carry you, you're going to be too heavy for them, then it's better not to be solid gold. It's better to be a little wood in between. If we're talking about hidurim, you want to be mahadir, you want to be machmer, it's very, very good, as long as nobody else has to carry you. But if somebody else has to carry you, and it's not you carrying yourself, then maybe it's better not to be machmer and to wait till you get married and you're carrying yourself, and then you can be machmer all you want, but not to be machmer on your mother's expense. Because the aron would have been much nicer to be solid gold, but if the people who had to carry it couldn't carry it, then it's better not to be solid gold. So I think there's a tremendous mussar to learn from what seems to be a very balabatish dazakenim, but I think there's a lot of mussar to learn from that dazakenim. Okay, yes?
Isn't it like, so a person shouldn't like, isn't there a concept that a person like shouldn't like just step aside and like watch like while like they know that something is wrong? That's like, let's say like people always tell horror stories of girls coming back from seminary and yelling at their parents for doing all these crazy things, like for doing these things that like they say are completely austere. So like what do you do? If, like you know like.
So, there is hidurim, and there's isurim. They're not the same. They're chumras, and they're halachas. The problem with the generation today, and it may not just be only this generation, is that people have no hasaga what halacha is. So, because they don't know what halacha is, there are some people who are machmir in things, and they think that's the halacha. And a male is somebody who keeps the halacha, they look at as a shegetz. And then there are people who are makel in things and think that's the halacha. And they look at people who do the regular halacha as fanatics. If everybody would know what the normative halacha is, and it's possible to be machmer, sometimes possible to be makel, then they have the perspective of everything being proper, memela. If we're talking about chumras and hidurim, then what I said is true. That if somebody else has to carry you, and your chumra is on somebody else's back, then maybe you shouldn't be machmer. But on the other hand, if something's wrong, right, it's mamash shalokadin, so then, sometimes, it's wrong according to normative halacha. But there are kulas. There's what to be makel and to be lenient more than what the normative halacha is. Sometimes that's what is desirable in a case where it's going to cause shalom bayis problems or may cause different kinds of problems, whatever. So sometimes it's possible to say, under the circumstances, even though halachically this is not okay, but since b'di'evit there are kulas, there are leniencies, now's the time to be somach on those leniencies. Sometimes there are no leniencies. It's out and out, no good.
So you should just wait.
Then, so what I suggest, I usually save this for the end of the year, what I suggest is the following. That before you tell your parents that what they've been doing for who knows how long, and especially parents that are frum, think they're frum, right, and have been doing things, you know, keeping Shabbos and eating kosher for years and years, and all of a sudden you come back with the revelation that what they've been doing for all these years is no good, and they better change, and that is very threatening, and sometimes it's wrong. Before you make an issue of anything, you should go and speak to a Rav who knows your parents, who knows you, who knows the situation in the community, and who can therefore advise you where it's kedai to make an issue and where it's kedai not to make an issue. And if it's kedai to make an issue, how to do it. Don't do it on your own, because sometimes you can do more harm, Yiddishkeit-wise, than you'll do make benefit. Yeah.
So I'm sure that last year when I came back, there was something that I noticed that I thought was not okay, that I thought that I learned was not okay. So thank God, I emailed my rabbi, and my rabbi from my community, not someone
else. Right.
So, and he told me that wasn't the halacha. He told me what the halacha was, and that my parents were doing something that was perfectly mutter, and that
you made a mistake or whatever, or the person who taught you based on a standard that maybe wasn't the standard of your community.
Right, so Baruch Shem, because really I could have been
bad. Right, no, it's for sure it's good to ask before you let your parents regret spending all that money of sending you here, right, and feeling that you're totally ungrateful, right, and you make them into shkotzim when they were from people before you went to Eretz Yisrael, right? And sometimes they're 100% right. So it's not kedai to make an issue until you find out if it's an issue. Okay. Next piece from this. It says that tocho kibaro, the inside should be like the outside. That's the description of a Talmud Chacham. What does that imply? Which comes first, the inside or the outside? The inside should be like the outside.
The outside,
and then you make the inside conform to the outside. That doesn't sound nice. Which is the ikker, the pnimius or the chitzonius? So why don't we emphasize the pnimius first, not the chitzonius? First, make the chitzonius, and then hope that the pnimius will become like that. First, put on a show? What does that mean? Why does it tocho kibaro? First, we should emphasize that our pnimius is good, and then we should make the outside fit the inside. Why do you make the inside fit the outside? I'll tell you another story. I had a woman in my kehila who grew up in I hate to use labels, but for want of something better, in a more modern Orthodox home. I don't know what that means, that they had ovens and refrigerators and it's modern Orthodox. They didn't have ice boxes and in a more, maybe a better description would be what they call it here in Israel, dati light. You know, not too serious about Yiddishkeit, you know, do it, but don't get carried away. That was the atmosphere she grew up in. And kosherous, you know, anything that somebody said was kosher was good enough. If it had a K somewhere in the name of the ingredients, was good enough also, right? Even if it said Kraft K, was good enough. Shabbos, you know, as long as you didn't drive and you didn't answer the phone, right? Don't confuse me with all these other laws. And that was the home she grew up in. And basically, she was a frumle, Shomer Shabbos, kosher, but again, very to the minimum. And she had a child, and she started to become more serious about Yiddishkeit. And she and her husband decided that they're going to upgrade their Shmiras HaMitzvahs. And they started with kashrus, and they re-kashered their home, and they started to be makbid only on good hechsherim. And then they started learning Hilchas Shabbos, and they upgraded their Shmira Shabbos, slowly, surely. And after about a year or two, I felt that she's ready for the next step. And that was Tznius. Now, in Miami, you have to understand that Tznius was not an easy thing. And in those days, perhaps the Klei Kodesh, the day school teachers' wives, the Rabbonim's wives dressed tzanua, surely covered their hair. But 90% of the rest of the kehila, right, did not dress tzanua. Right? They were lucky if they dressed all together in Miami, and they didn't dress tzanua, and most married women didn't cover their hair. And it was accepted that that's, you know, what's it called? If you cover your hair, you're a rebbetzin. Normal women don't cover their hair. Okay, married women. So I felt this woman is upgrading her Shmiras HaMitzvahs, is becoming really serious, so I called her in one day and I said, I think you're ready for the next stage. I think the next stage is Tznius, that you should start dressing properly and cover your hair. She said, Rabbi, I don't want to be a hypocrite. I don't feel on the inside like a Rebbetzin. and I don't want to look like a Rebbetzin and fool people into thinking that I'm something I'm not. When I feel like a Rebbetzin, I'll start dressing like one. That was her answer to me. I said, you know what you can be compared to? The following. Somebody comes to shul on Simchas Torah, and he says, I'm not really happy. So if I get up and dance, people are going to think that I'm happy, and I'm going to be a hypocrite. So I'm going to sit here and contemplate being happy, and as soon as I'm happy, I'm going to get up and dance. The guy will sit there till Tisha B'Av. He'll never get up and dance. How do you get happy? You dance. That's not hypocrisy. The chitzonius is ma'ora, the pnimius. That's all of Yiddishkeit. You go through the motions, and motions create emotions. You go through the motions of the Maisa mitzvahs, and they're supposed to, the chinuch says, somehow condition you to feel and to believe and to do. So that's not hypocrisy. Hypocrisy is where I don't want to do this, and I don't really believe in it, but I want people to think I want to put on an act. That's hypocrisy. But I want to do it. I want to feel like that. I want to be happy. But in order to do it, I have to dance. I'm not putting on a show. I'm doing what's necessary to get where I want to get. I said, if you continue dressing untsanua, you'll never feel tsanua. But if you start dressing in a tsanua way, eventually you'll feel on the inside tsanua. That's how you get to feel tsanua. It's not going to happen by itself. It happens by conditioning, by going through the motions. And therefore, it says, tocho kibaro. You have to start with the outside. That's the way that the Torah is. Outside first, then finally you get to the inside. That's very nice, and that does explain the way that Chazal described the Aram. But the Torah seems to say something else. The Torah says, V'tzipisa oso zahav tahar, mi bayis umichutz titzapenu. Which comes first? The bayis, inside. And then bachutz. So why does the Torah say it in the opposite order that Chazal described it? Chazal described it outside and then inside, and the Torah says first the inside, then the outside. So I was thinking, no, the Torah doesn't say that. The Torah says the following. Let's say it would only have said that Tzipisa oso zahav tahar. That's all it would have said about the Aram. Where would you put the gold? On the outside. Like all the other kelim. You cover it with gold. On the outside. Then it says Mibayis on the inside. And then again it says Bachutz on the outside. So there was three stages. First on the outside, just like Chazal say. Then on the inside. And then again on the outside. Now, when did that happen? The answer is simple. How did they gild the Aram? Rashi says, they had three boxes. A little box of gold, a medium-sized box of wood, and a big box of gold. They first put the big box, the medium-sized box of wood inside the box of gold. Now it was gilded where? On the outside. Then they put the little box of gold inside the box of wood. Now it was gilded on the inside. Outside, inside. What was missing? The rim. If you look down, what did you see? Three layers. You saw gold, wood, and gold. Everywhere else it was covered. But on the rim, if you look down at it, it was wood, gold, wood, gold. So now they had to take gold and cover the rim of the wood so it would be covered with gold completely. That was again on the outside. So they started with the outside, then went to the inside, and then again to the outside. So we said that the symbolism of outside first and then inside is that you have to go through the motions to get emotions. You have to start with the outside. You can't start with the inside. But then what is the symbolism of the outside again after you did the inside? So let's go back to the guy on Simchas Torah. He's dancing to get happy. Now he feels happy. Should he stop dancing? Or should he continue? He's happy. The whole purpose of dancing was to get happy. Now I'm happy with the Torah. So should I stop dancing?
No.
Why? Why? What? No, I'll remain happy. Now I've reached a level I can remain happy. It's if he could remain happy, would he should stop dancing?
No.
There's a mila of expressing your emotions physically. There's a Ramban in his Perush to the Aseres HaDibros not in the Chumash. It's a separate sefer, Perish to Aseres HaDibros. And he explains a pasuk in Shir HaShirim. The pasuk says like this: Mata'iru u'mata'oru esa'ava ad shetechpots. Says the Ramban, what it means is the following: do not arouse feelings of avas Hashem or yiras Hashem or simchas hamitzvahs or whatever emotions are involved in Torah. Do not arouse them ad shetechpots until you can put it into some chefetz. You can put it in something tangible. Because emotions that are purely ethereal are not as strong as emotions that you can express physically. We live in a physical world, and therefore what makes an impression on us is physical things. And therefore, expressing your simcha by dancing is stronger than just having the emotion of simcha within you. So first you have to dance to get happy. And once you're happy, then you again express that happiness in a physical way by continuing dancing. So the physical is on both ends. It starts to initiate the feelings, and once you have the feelings, you express them again physically. The Ramban, according to this, is very good l'shitasa. Because the Ramban holds that Olam Haba and Tchiyas HaNesim are the same thing. And that Olam Haba, even though there's no eating and drinking, but it's a physical world. A eternal physical world where the neshama and the body will be reunited. And that is eternal. That's called Olam Haba. Unlike the Rambam, who says that Olam Haba is a totally spiritual world. So they ask on the Ramban, if people don't eat and they don't drink, and they basically don't need the body, then why do you have a body? What's the purpose of the body in Olam Haba, Tchiyas HaNesim? If there's no eating, no drinking, right, the neshama is able to exist in the body without the body needing to eat and drink, then what do you need a body for? The answer is this idea. In this world, in order to maintain the neshama, you have to start with a physical being. First you need a candle, then you can have the flame. You need a healthy body, you have to eat and drink and maintain the neshama. Once you have the neshama working, it expresses itself in a physical way through the body. So you start with the body in order to maintain and enhance the neshama, and then the neshama expresses itself through the body. In Olam Haba Tchiyas HaMesim, you don't need the body to enhance the neshama. The neshama can exist without the body maintaining it. But you still need the body to express the neshama. In fact, Rav Moshe Cordoviro says, big mekubel, he says that the neshamas in Gan Eden look forward to Tchiyas HaMesim as much as we look forward to Mashiach. Because being a neshama in a spiritual world is not the highest level. The highest level is being a neshama in a body where the body can express what the neshama feels and is. Because expressing it physically is more real than expressing it ethereally, esoterically, spiritually. It's more real when it comes into the physical world. So therefore, the Aron was gilded first on the outside, which represents that you have to start with the outside. Then it comes to the inside, and then again on the outside, because once you reach those tremendous emotions, now express them again physically, because that's what gives them body and reality and makes them much more significant.